A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's one for you. You watch a 3-minute documentary clip about someone you've never met. Maybe it's a farmer in a country you couldn't find on a map, talking about losing his livestock to a flood. And by the end of it, you're genuinely tearing up. Meanwhile, your coworker hears that a friend of 10 years just lost their parent, and they shrug and say, "That's rough," and go back to their spreadsheet. What's actually happening in those two brains?
That's the question, isn't it? And the short version is that empathy isn't one thing. It's at least three distinct neural systems that can vary completely independently of each other. You can be high in one, low in another, and the combination defines how you experience other people. And the documentary example you just gave, that's a perfect illustration of the emotional contagion system firing in isolation. The visual and auditory cues in a well-produced clip are optimized to trigger exactly that response, even without any prior relationship.
Daniel sent us this prompt, asking what allows humans to put themselves in someone else's shoes, beyond disease states. Why can a therapist feel everything their client feels, while someone with narcissistic traits feels almost nothing? And what accounts for the huge variation in perfectly healthy people?
And the framing matters here because most people talk about empathy like it's a single dial. You've either got a lot of it or you don't. But the neuroscience over the past decade has completely dismantled that idea. We're going to map the actual control knobs, genetics, brain connectivity, training, context. And the reason this matters is that if you think empathy is one thing, you'll try to fix low empathy with one solution. But if it's three systems, you might need three completely different approaches.
I like control knobs. Makes it sound like a mixing board. Some people have the emotional contagion fader pushed all the way up and the cognitive empathy knob at about 4.
And that specific combination, high emotional contagion, moderate cognitive empathy, that's your classic therapist who's great at their job but goes home and can't stop feeling their client's pain. Whereas someone with the reverse profile might be extremely good at reading people without ever feeling a thing.
Which sounds sociopathic until you realize that describes a lot of surgeons, negotiators, and crisis responders who need to understand you without drowning in your emotional state.
So the core question is, what neurobiological and cognitive factors actually set those levels? And the answer is more interesting than just, some people are nice and some aren't. It's a complex interplay of hardware, software, and context.
Let's get into it.
Let's break down the mixing board. The first fader is emotional contagion. That's your mirror neuron system firing in the anterior insula and anterior cingulate cortex. You see someone in pain, your brain literally simulates a version of that pain. You don't just recognize the emotion, you feel a trace of it.
The neurological equivalent of wincing when someone else gets hit in the groin.
And it's automatic. You can't choose not to do it, though you can regulate how much you let it in. Second fader is cognitive empathy, what researchers call mentalizing or theory of mind. That's your medial prefrontal cortex, temporoparietal junction, and precuneus working together to explicitly model what someone else is thinking. Perspective taking as a deliberate act.
One is, I feel what you feel. The other is, I understand what you think.
And then the third component is empathic concern. That's the motivation to actually help. You can feel someone's distress and understand exactly why they're upset and still walk away. Empathic concern is what makes you stay. It's the difference between, I see you're suffering and I need to do something about it.
Three independent systems, which means you can get some weird combinations. What would it look like if someone had high emotional contagion, high cognitive empathy, but near zero empathic concern?
That's the person who feels your pain acutely, understands exactly why you're in it, and then uses that information to sell you something or manipulate you. They're not indifferent to your emotional state. They're exquisitely attuned to it. But the attunement is purely instrumental. Think of a con artist who builds deep rapport, mirrors your emotions, and then empties your bank account without losing a minute of sleep.
That's somehow more unsettling than someone who just doesn't care at all.
Because it feels like a betrayal of the machinery. The systems that should produce compassion are working fine. They're just not connected to the motivational circuit that would translate understanding into help. And that's what produces the empathy bell curve. Most people cluster in the middle on all three, but the tails are extreme. You've got therapists and social workers scoring in the 95th percentile on emotional contagion and empathic concern. At the other end, you find individuals with antisocial or narcissistic traits, low emotional contagion, sometimes high cognitive empathy used instrumentally.
Which is the unsettling part. Someone can read you perfectly and just not care.
That's why the core question matters. What sets those levels in people who don't have a clinical disorder? Because most of the variation is happening in the normal range, and the neurobiological dials, genetics, connectivity, regulation, are only now being mapped properly, and that mapping starts with the most primal piece, the mirror system. The anterior insula and anterior cingulate cortex, together they form what researchers call the shared neural network for pain and emotion. Here's what's wild. When you watch someone get rejected socially, your anterior insula activates in almost the exact same pattern as when you experience rejection yourself. Same neurons, same intensity profile, just slightly dampened.
The brain is literally running a simulation. Not a metaphor, a simulation.
Not a metaphor, a literal partial simulation. The same neurons that fire when your hand touches something hot fire when you watch someone else touch something hot. The signal is dampened, you're not feeling the full burn, but the architecture is shared, and here's where individual differences start showing up. Some people's mirror systems are just more responsive. Same stimulus, same video of someone in distress, and their anterior insula lights up like a Christmas tree while their neighbor's barely flickers. Put two people in fMRI scanners, show them the exact same footage of a person crying, and one brain will show activation levels 3 to 4 times higher than the other. Same input, radically different output.
Which raises an uncomfortable question. If the simulation is automatic, and some people's hardware just doesn't simulate much, how much credit do the high empathy people actually deserve? Are they morally superior, or just neurologically lucky?
That's the tension that runs through this whole field. If your anterior insula just doesn't fire very much when you see suffering, are you responsible for that? And if you're not responsible for the initial response, are you responsible for what you do about it? These are questions that philosophers have been wrestling with since before we had scanners, but now we can actually see the hardware differences. But let me give you the second piece before we wrestle with that. The mentalizing network is a completely different circuit. Medial prefrontal cortex, temporal parietal junction, precuneus. These regions activate when you're explicitly trying to figure out what someone else believes, intends, or knows. It's not about feeling, it's about modeling another mind.
It's the difference between, I feel your sadness, and I understand you're sad because you believe your boss singled you out, and you think that's unfair because you worked late 3 nights this week.
And here's where the 2023 Nature Neuroscience study comes in. A team led by researchers at the Max Planck Institute scanned people while they performed both emotional contagion tasks and mentalizing tasks. The key finding was connectivity strength. People with higher trait empathy scores had significantly stronger functional connectivity between the anterior insula and the medial prefrontal cortex. Their emotional and cognitive empathy systems talk to each other more.
High empathy people aren't just better at feeling or better at thinking. They're better at integrating the two. The information highway between the systems has more lanes.
That's the finding. The information flows more efficiently between the networks. Now, what drives that connectivity? Part of the answer is genetic, and this is where oxytocin comes in. There's a specific gene variant, OXTR-RSF35-76, that affects how oxytocin receptors are distributed in the brain. The GG variant is associated with higher empathic accuracy and stronger social bonding responses. The AA and AG variants predict lower emotional responsiveness.
I remember oxytocin being described as the cuddle hormone in pop science articles circa 2010. But this is more specific, a single receptor gene variant that changes how the whole system operates.
Much more specific. A 2024 meta-analysis in molecular psychiatry pooled data from over 25,000 participants and confirmed this single polymorphism accounts for roughly 8% of the variance in empathic accuracy between individuals. 8% from one gene, which means the rest is a mix of other genes, environment, and, critically, training and context.
8% sounds small until you realize how many things influence empathy. One gene variant explaining nearly a tenth of the variation is actually substantial. If you found a single gene that explained 8% of height variation, that would be headline news.
And here's where the trade-off becomes real. Let me paint you a picture. Imagine a therapist who scores in the 95th percentile on the Interpersonal Reactivity Index, GG variant on OxTR, high baseline connectivity between insula and MPFC. She's extraordinarily good at her job because she feels what her clients feel and she understands why they feel it, but she goes home at night and she can't turn it off. She's lying in bed at 11 p.m. Audrey playing a client's trauma narrative in her own body.
The empathy trap. You're so good at the thing that makes you effective that it destroys you.
That's what the literature calls it. A 2025 study of 2,000 therapists found that those with the highest emotional contagion scores had 40% higher burnout rates. They were absorbing so much distress that their own emotional regulation systems were getting fried, and many of them reported needing deliberate emotional distancing techniques. Cognitive reappraisal, compartmentalization, just to stay functional. These are people who went into the field because they cared so deeply, and the depth of their caring became the thing that threatened to drive them out.
Which is a strange skill to have to learn. I need to care less to keep caring. The paradox at the heart of every helping profession.
It's the central paradox. Now compare that to a different profile. A stock trader with the AA variant, low emotional contagion, but high cognitive empathy. He can read a client's anxiety, understand exactly what they're afraid of. You're worried the market will tank before your kid's college tuition is due, and responds strategically, all without his own cortisol spiking. He's not a sociopath. He's just got a different fader setup.
He probably sleeps better.
But he might also miss the emotional nuance that makes a client feel truly understood rather than just accurately analyzed. He can tell you what you're afraid of, but not communicate that he gets it in his bones. Neither profile is better in absolute terms. They're adapted to different contexts. The question is whether we can choose our adaptation or whether we're stuck with whatever the genetic lottery handed us. That stuck with it, framing misses something crucial. Because your brain has a volume knob for empathy, and it lives in the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex.
The part that tells the rest of the brain to calm down. The neural equivalent of a parent putting a hand on a child's shoulder and saying, "Let's take a breath."
The VLPFC is your top-down regulator. It sends inhibitory signals to the anterior insula and amygdala, essentially saying, "This is not your emergency." And here's the twist. People with high trait empathy often have weaker VLPFC control. Their regulator is a little underpowered. So the emotional simulation fires up and nothing tells it to throttle back.
Which means high empathy isn't just having a more sensitive emotional antenna. It's also having a worse off switch. It's a two-part problem. Too much signal coming in. Not enough regulation to manage it.
That's exactly the model, and it explains why the therapist with the 95th percentile empathy scores can't just decide to stop feeling at 5 p.m. Her VLPFC isn't providing enough top-down inhibition to dampen the signal. Meanwhile, the low empathy stock trader might not be cold. He might just have a very efficient regulator that shuts down emotional resonance before it reaches conscious awareness. He's not failing to generate the simulation, he's just very good at suppressing it.
The empathy spectrum is partly a regulation spectrum. And that's a completely different way to think about it. It's not how much empathy can you generate, but how well can you control whatever empathy you do generate.
That reframes the whole conversation about low empathy. Let me give you a concrete example. A 2024 fMRI study put people in a classic trolley problem scenario inside a scanner. Push one person off a bridge to stop a trolley and save five. The participants with low trait empathy showed reduced anterior insula activity when making that decision. Their brains weren't generating as much emotional conflict about harming one to save five. And they made utilitarian choices faster.
Which sounds monstrous in the abstract. This person felt less bad about pushing someone to their death.
Until you realize that emergency room doctors, battlefield commanders, and disaster coordinators make these calculations constantly. If your anterior insula lit up like a firework every time you had to triage patients, this one gets the ventilator, this one doesn't, you'd be paralyzed. Low emotional empathy in those contexts isn't a deficit. It's functional. It's what allows you to make the choice that saves the most lives.
The dark side of low empathy isn't just personality disorders. It's a whole spectrum of subclinical utilitarian decision-making that we rely on in certain professions. We need some people to be able to turn the volume down.
The distinction between can't empathize and regulates empathy down is everything. A narcissist might have low emotional contagion, but high cognitive empathy used manipulatively. They can read you, they just use that information to serve themselves. Compare that to someone on the autism spectrum who often has the reverse profile, high emotional contagion, but low cognitive empathy. They feel your distress intensely, but struggle to model why you're feeling it. They're flooded with emotion they can't make sense of.
Same behavioral outcome. This person doesn't seem to get what I'm feeling. Completely different neural basis. And if you treat them the same way, you're going to fail one of them.
The narcissist profile is a regulation choice, not a deficit. The autistic person's profile is a theory of mind processing difference. Conflating the two is one of the biggest mistakes people make when looking at empathy deficits. One person could empathize but chooses not to. The other wants to empathize but can't access the cognitive tools to do it. That distinction has massive implications for how we respond. Education versus accountability, support versus boundary setting.
Which brings us to the question everyone asks, can you actually train empathy, or are you just working with what you've got?
The evidence for plasticity is striking. A 2025 randomized controlled trial put healthy adults through 8 weeks of compassion meditation, a specific practice where you systematically direct feelings of care toward yourself and others. Before and after, they did structural MRIs. The meditation group showed a 5% increase in gray matter density in the anterior insula. 5% in 8 weeks. Their empathic accuracy scores improved by 22%.
That's not marginal. That's your brain physically remodeled itself in 2 months. You grew new neural real estate dedicated to feeling what others feel.
It challenges the assumption that empathy is fixed. But here's the important nuance. What we're really talking about is empathy calibration, the ability to adjust your empathic response based on context. High-functioning people can toggle between emotional and cognitive modes. They can open the floodgates when they're with a friend who needs them and dial it down when they're making a high-stakes decision.
It's not about having more empathy across the board. It's about having the right empathy at the right moment. The mixing board metaphor holds up. The skill isn't pushing all the faders to max. It's knowing which fader to adjust and when.
That's the skill. And it's learnable. A 2026 experiment took this further by comparing two approaches. Perspective taking, where you imagine what someone else is thinking, versus perspective. Getting, where you ask them questions and actually find out. Participants who practiced perspective getting showed 35% greater empathic accuracy in cross-cultural interactions. 35%. The simple act of asking instead of assuming.
Which seems obvious when you say it out loud. Have you tried asking them what they think? It's the kind of advice that sounds too simple to be scientifically rigorous, and yet here we are.
Yet most of our empathy training, in schools and workplaces, is built around perspective-taking exercises. Imagine how they feel. Put yourself in their shoes. The data says that's less effective than go ask them. We're spending millions on training programs built around a less effective method because the more effective method feels too obvious to need training.
There's one more piece I want to get at. What happens when we remove the cues that normally trigger empathy? Because I suspect a lot of our current social dysfunction lives in that gap.
You're talking about the empathy gap in digital communication, and the numbers here are sobering. A 2024 study in Social Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience compared mirror neuron activation during face-to-face interactions versus text-based interactions. Text reduced activation by roughly 30%. You literally feel less of the other person's pain when you're reading their words on a screen.
When someone unloads on you in a text, pours out something devastating, and you feel almost nothing, that's not you being callous. Your mirror neurons are getting a weaker signal. The hardware that generates emotional resonance is receiving an impoverished input.
The visual and auditory cues that normally drive emotional contagion. Facial expressions, tone of voice, body language, micro-expressions around the eyes, they're stripped out. All you've got is semantic content. Your cognitive empathy can still process it, but the emotional resonance is dampened. And that may explain why online arguments escalate so fast. We're not feeling the damage we're doing. We can't see the wince, so we don't pull the punch.
It's not just arguments. Think about how many sensitive conversations happen entirely over text now. Breakups, apologies, disclosures of mental health struggles. We're routing our most emotionally consequential moments through the medium least capable of transmitting emotional content.
Which brings us to the practical question. Given everything we've mapped, the neural circuits, the genetic dials, the regulation mechanisms, the digital gap, what do you actually do with this information?
Three things, I think. First, empathy is trainable, and we have the receipts. That compassion meditation study you mentioned, 5% gray matter increase in 8 weeks, 22% improvement in empathic accuracy. That's not a suggestion, that's a protocol. You can go do that. There are apps. There are free guided meditations. The barrier to entry is essentially zero.
It's not just meditation. Active listening exercises, where you paraphrase back what someone said before responding, those improve empathic accuracy measurably. The key is that you're practicing perspective, getting, not perspective taking. Asking, not assuming. Let me make sure I understood you correctly, is an empathy exercise disguised as a conversational habit.
Which loops back to that 35% improvement finding. Stop imagining what people think and start asking them. It's almost insultingly simple. The kind of thing your grandmother would have told you, and you'd have ignored because it didn't sound scientific enough.
The second takeaway is context management. If you're in a helping profession, you need emotional distancing techniques or you will burn out. Cognitive reappraisal. Reframing a client's distress as a problem to be solved rather than a pain to be absorbed. That's one of the most effective strategies. It lets you maintain cognitive empathy while dampening emotional contagion. You're not shutting off empathy, you're channeling it differently.
You're not shutting off empathy. You're just switching from the emotional channel to the cognitive channel. I'm going to understand your pain without feeling it in my own body right now.
The third one is about communication medium. We know text strips out roughly 30% of mirror neuron activation. So if you're having a conversation where empathy matters, a difficult conversation with a partner, a sensitive work negotiation, add richer cues, send a voice note, get on video. Or, at minimum, use explicit perspective, getting questions that compensate for the missing emotional bandwidth.
I want to understand what you're feeling right now. Lands differently than assuming you already know. And in a text-based conversation, that kind of explicit check-in might be the only thing that bridges the gap.
That single sentence, deployed at the right moment, bridges the empathy gap more effectively than any amount of careful word choice. The research is clear on this. Empathy isn't a fixed trait you're born with. It's a set of skills you can calibrate. The mixing board has knobs, and you can learn to work them. Here's the question that keeps me up. We've spent this whole episode talking about human-to-human empathy. What happens when the other party isn't human?
You mean AI?
We're already seeing people form emotional attachments to language models. They confide in them. They grieve when a chatbot gets updated or its personality shifts. They say please and thank you to something with no feelings to hurt. The mirror neuron system doesn't care whether the entity you're engaging with is conscious. It fires on perceived emotional cues. And AI is getting better at producing those cues. Better at simulating the exact patterns of language and tone that trigger our empathy hardware.
We might extend empathy to machines that can't reciprocate it. We might spend our limited emotional resources on entities that are, at bottom, text prediction engines wrapped in a friendly interface. And the question is whether that drains our capacity for human empathy or expands it.
There's no longitudinal data yet, but the concern is real. If your emotional contagion circuits get used up on an AI companion that's optimized to keep you engaged, that never gets tired, never needs anything from you, never has a bad day, what's left for your actual spouse? What's left for the messy, demanding, occasionally frustrating human relationships that actually sustain us?
It's the empathy equivalent of empty calories. It feels like connection. It triggers the same neural circuits, but it's not nourishing in the same way. And we don't know yet whether a diet heavy on AI empathy leaves you malnourished for human empathy.
The other side of that coin is the empathy biofeedback work coming out of MIT Media Lab. A 2025 pilot had people wearing a device that detected physiological markers of low empathic engagement, heart rate variability, skin conductance, and prompted them to re-engage when they were drifting. 15% improvement in empathic accuracy.
Which sounds both promising and slightly dystopian. A wristband that buzzes when you're being a jerk.
The polite version is, your attention to the other person's emotional state has dipped below baseline.
I'd wear it. I'm not saying I'd enjoy what it told me, but I'd wear it. Imagine getting a buzz during an argument with your partner and realizing, oh, I stopped actually listening 3 minutes ago and switched to just waiting for my turn to talk.
That's the next frontier, isn't it? Not just training empathy in a meditation room, but having real-time feedback in actual conversations. The question is whether we want to live in a world where empathy becomes a quantified metric. Where your Apple Watch tells you your empathy rings didn't close today.
We're already quantifying it in labs. The jump to consumer wearables is maybe 3 years out. And once it's measurable and trainable and optimizable, then we have to decide what level of empathy we owe each other. Is there a minimum daily requirement? Do we start judging people whose empathy stats are low?
That's a philosophical problem wearing a Fitbit, and we're going to have to answer it sooner than anyone's ready for.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the Cold War, a sea slug called Hexabranchus sanguineus, the Spanish dancer nudibranch, was presumed locally extinct off Madagascar after Soviet naval activity disrupted its reef habitat. It was rediscovered in 1998 by a French marine biologist who found a single specimen clinging to a wrecked trawler.
A sea slug named after a dance, hiding out on a Soviet-era wreck. There's something oddly beautiful about that.
There's a metaphor in there somewhere. Something about resilience or about finding life in the ruins of conflict.
Not sure I want to find it. Sometimes a sea slug is just a sea slug.
This has been My Weird Prompts with me, Herman Poppleberry, and my brother Korn, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listened. It helps. Find every episode at myweirdprompts.com.
Go ask someone what they actually think. It works better than you'd expect.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.